Yeah, was. Is 95 kilowatts. It's a big change in power density, but you got to remember it's spread evenly across 6 megahertz. It's taking a lot of energy to make that in the first place. Let me let it drop for a second. Right. So you have those issues. There's also something called enhanced VSD, which is diddling the trellis a little bit and using only 4 bits instead of 8 bits and having good mobile reception. That's been demonstrated, and it can also be used to send to cell phones. But the newer technologies, as they're getting around to it now, actually the 5th generation equalizer's been around for a while, but it hasn't been in production, but now it's in mass production. And it's coming out in the new boxes, and it's actually making digital television work, whereas it, in the beginning, when they first started broadcasting ATSC, which is the American Television Standards Committee, decided on the current transmission method, it was pretty tough. I have some old receivers that if you don't feed them a good signal, they don't make a picture. K2RWK, Tuesday.
Okay, some very nice numbers you gave me there. A little bit more, I think you said, than 17 dB of gain in the antenna. 60,000 watts out of the transmitter. 17 dB of gain is a 50-to-1 ratio. I multiply 50 times 60,000 watts, and you're over 3 million watts of effective radiated power. 3 or 3.5 million watts, I think, is channel 21 locally. That signal received directly with no multipath would be nice and easy to get. But in the real world, you're always going to be getting multipath. And so you told us, I think, minus 50 and plus 300, I think you said. Out of curiosity, is that microseconds? I'm guessing that's microseconds. It can't be milliseconds. I said milliseconds. It's got to be micro. Each nanosecond, 10 to the minus 9 seconds, is 1 foot approximately of propagation in free air. 1 microsecond is roughly 1,000 nanoseconds, 1,000 feet. So 300 microseconds would be 300,000, what are we talking here, about 20 miles of difference in path length. It seems like an awful lot. So run those numbers by one more time. Is it minus 50 plus 250 or something like that you gave us, Eric, on the fifth generation equalizer network? And that's enough for now. Back to you, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2J. Well, you have to consider that the equalizer is actually a DSP in hardware, the way it works. But it goes from minus 75 microseconds of pre-reflection, or pre-ghost, if you want to call it that, to it can go out further, but it goes out 300 microseconds, the way they manufacture the chip. I think the Samsung is 250 and the LG is 300. LG is the parent company of Zenith, so. And some of the better boxes, believe it or not, are the Zenith boxes. They're very cute. They're small. They look like a piece of garbage, but they work real well. So, I mean, that's the name of the game. And given more time, they will be able to make the equalizers even better. It's more complex than, there's after you equalize it, there's the breaking it down into its actual bits. It's not just the multiplexing, actually. It has an RF error correction trellis, which helps in the process of transmission. So there's a lot of things that are going on, but it's from minus 75 microseconds pre-ghost to plus 300 microseconds post-ghost, and making it go longer is easy. Making it go before it actually exists is a problem.
Now, I also have the impression with digital television that 2, 3, and 4 pieces of programming running simultaneously can be transmitted over the same 6 megacycle wide channel. So in theory, I could go to channel 13-1, 13-2, 13-3, and in other words, properly set up my receiver, and I can decide which one of the programming streams I'm going to listen to or watch over my particular, that while it's tuned to literally the frequency of channel 13, if I understand correctly. What's the maximum number of those channels that can be put in there, Eric? And is that done by some form of time domain sharing, or is it by way of the digital code going into packets? And so you're transmitting packets of each one of those programs somewhat sequentially. And of course, this is all using MPEG compression techniques where not the whole picture is being updated, only the portions that moved from frame to frame. Give us a couple words on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the technical net.
All right, Dick, I'll make it simple. K2RIW, K2EJ. Consider, all right, most people don't really understand what Ethernet is, but let's consider, so let's go from the simplest level. A television picture in analog is a varying waveform of voltage, okay, and has a specific period of time in which you can show a line of video which goes from, say, white to black, and then we go and do the next line. Now, that's in the analog way of doing things. That's what we're going to start off with, and that's what we're going to end with. So what we've got to do is we've got to turn that stuff into digits. We do it via MPEG compression, right? And so we take the video, we feed it into a box, take the audio and feed it into the same box, and then we get something out of it called an MPEG stream, which everybody's used to seeing on their computer. And they don't realize that that actual MPEG stream is broken up into little packets, and it's brought along with, you know, the information of what address am I going to, and where do I have to end up. So the very basic MPEG stream, we'll call that an elementary stream. That has packets of video and audio, okay, and it has something called a PID, or a program ID. And with every group of packets, there's actually 181 packets in a little string there. So those 181 packets, they'll be an address, and it'll say PID 30. Which actually will happen to be channel 1 of the first channel of a digital stream. Hang on. So, we have an elementary stream which has video packet and audio packet, and they have identifiers attached to them. Well, we could have 4 of them, and they would have 4 separate wires going into a box, and it has to kind of like merge these things together. And what we do is we insert those elementary streams into something called a transport stream. The transport stream says, oh, I'm channel 13. And the transport stream says, oh, I've got the information of what's on when that puts it up on your screen display, if, you know, what's on TV. And in that transport stream, I could also have some IP data that I'm sending to a police booth somewhere. And that's called IP over DTV. And in that support stream, I have these 4 other streams of MPEG video, which your tuner will actually pick out because the transport stream has a table in it called a channel assignment table. And it'll say, oh, PID number 30, that's 13HG. Oh, PID number 42. That's 13 kids. PID number 56, that's VMA, in the case of channel 13. And the associated audio PIDs will go with that. And basically, let me let it drop. And basically the receiver says, oh, I need PID 30 and 34. So it looks at this stream, this transport stream that's gone by, and anytime it sees a PID number 30, it says, oh, I need those. I'll take those and I'll put them in a buffer and I'll ship them out to my MPEG decoder so I can make video back from it. So every time a PID number that it needs comes by, it grabs it and sends that to the MPEG decoder. And that's the basic way it works. It's something called a transport stream that has all the elementary streams packed in it. And the smartest of the receivers says, oh, I need that one, and it goes and grabs it. K2RIW, KE2J.
Fantastic. Television has just gotten a lot more complicated. And when you're transmitting 4 program pieces of information simultaneously, live, let's see, I presume some trade-off is done as to instantaneous bandwidth. If one of those programs, which is my usual example, happens to be showing the movie Grand Prix, and the scene is being panned at 160 miles an hour, and everything on that scene is moving, as opposed to another program, which is a couple of talking heads doing an interview of each other, and very little of the scene is moving. I presume you're doing a trade-off of bandwidth as to how big are the packets and how many of the packets for the Grand Prix movie versus the talking heads. And I presume that's dynamically balanced on a frame-by-frame basis. Is that approximately correct, Eric? Go ahead.
Somewhat close. Good deduction. Very good deduction. Actually, we do something that's called statistical multiplexing. Essentially, when we put a video signal into a DTV encoder, it actually doesn't come out until many frames later. So if you were actually to switch from, say, 13 analog and went to 13 digital, you'll see there's almost a 3.5 second delay between what you see on the digital and what you see on the analog. The analog is pretty much instantaneous line of, you know, speed of light from coming out of the camera, going through whatever delays there are on the plant, which can be as much as 128 microseconds into the transmitter, and out it goes. Whereas if the digital signal is going to go into the encoder and sit there for a little bit. And the reason for that is partly to compress it, we need to know what comes before and what comes after so that we can decide what bits of information to turn into coefficients and what bits of information to say, okay, well, this can be run length encoding, which is a whole other conversation. We do that. Alright, and by the way, to answer your question, how many streams can you put on? You can put as many as you want. You just, you know, you might as well have still pictures on everything, because as you take bandwidth away, the thing that you affect the most is not image quality in terms of sharpness. You damage things that have motion. If you look carefully, even at the best high-def TVs, and when you see something moving fast, if you look at the trailing side of it, it doesn't quite look like there's something going on there, like there's a little digi thing that's happening, and that those are the artifacts. When we're watching high-definition television on over the air, we're actually taking a signal that starts at 1.16 gigabits, and we shrink it down to maybe, well, CBS uses their whole bandwidth. They use 18 megahertz. NBC uses about 15, and they have two other channels. One is like a half a megabit, and the other one, I think, is a meg and a half, where 13, we'll squeeze it down to 14, which is, you know, not the best in the world, but we give some bandwidth to the other two channels so they don't look so bad. I think Kids runs at about 2, and Deme runs at around 3. And I like W, I'm a stinker, because I run the three channels there, 6 megahertz, 6 megabits. They look really nice. I mean, they drop. But the reality is that you only got so much landscape, and how you fill the landscape up. The smart thing about the statistical multiplexing, it'll say, is, oh, the HD channel needs a little more bandwidth, so I'm going to give you some more bandwidth, and I'm going to take it away from the other two, and I'll decide which one I should take it from. So the one that's having the least amount of motion, the one that leaves the least bandwidth because things aren't changing, I'll take it from that and give it to the HD one. You got to consider that each one of these pixels that goes by is like a nanosecond. So we're talking about some pretty fast computing going on here. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah. It sounds to me, Eric, like a modern-day demodulator, digital television demodulator, has got either a pretty good microprocessor or a number of simultaneously running microprocessors to do all this. Is that approximately true?
Actually, well, you're thinking microprocessors in a conventional sense, but, you know, like the Xeon X or the Altera chips, they're basically hardware chips designed in software, where that you actually need a special DSP. You design it mathematically, and then it magically becomes that circuit. So in this stuff, because of the very fast clock times, the traditional, even if the Harvard architecture DSP is not particularly fast enough. So we will use these types of programmable assets to make the devices that we need to clock fast enough, because they can build them out of other materials that are much faster. If you think of the ECL from the old days, it's kind of like that.
Okay, here's my last question then. A really good high quality fifth generation digital demodulator system for the consumer receiver. Is he running a clock rate roughly 1 gigabit per second? Go ahead.
Well, if you're going to feed your brand new TV set HDMI, yeah, you're going to be running 1.16 gigabits through that cable. That's why the cable can only be like 6 feet long. There's a restriction to how long it is because the capacitance kills you. You know, when you've got bits flying around like that, they don't land, they don't stay square for very long. That's actually one of the problems on the broadcast side. We use a standard called HDSDI, or High Definition Serial Digital Interface. And with the standard definition TV, which only runs at 270 megabits, you can run 1,000 feet of that cable without a problem, without even thinking about it. When it comes to HDSDI, you're lucky if you can get 300 feet.
Has anybody ever built an intermediate set of amplifiers for the cable with reconstituting the squareness of the wave? Or is that, does that start giving you time domain shifts that are intolerable? Over to you, Eric.
No, broadcast equipment manufacturers are pretty smart. We generally don't have a need to run that long a coax because we tend to use fiber optics these days. And, when you go to the garden or places like that and you see they're shooting the sports in high definition, they're not using copper, they're using glass. That's really kind of the only way. When you start approaching those speeds, that becomes the proficient way to do things. And the manufacture of glass has gotten so good, you can hardly tell it. That's actually more durable, more flexible than some of the coax stuff. Cameras traditionally use something called triax, which is two shields and a semiconductor. It's, you know, three conductive elements where usually you feed 100 volts down the cable to power the camera head. And that stuff is good because, you know, we actually don't realize that you're sending the video down the cable at like 40 megahertz. So you're really transmitting it back to the base unit, even though it's going through a cable. But since the coming of fiber optics, all the issues that we used to have with that kind of stuff have just disappeared. Because if you consider where you're going to use coax, it's either in a control room or a truck or some small enclosed space where you have to get your signal from one device to the next. KTRIW, KU2J, also the actual rate of the HD over the air might only be, 14 or 15 megabits. So there you go.
Would I be correct in assuming that fiber optics, properly designed and used, has, for all practical purposes, almost no dispersion to it, no group delay distortion for the frequency bandwidth that you're using for a one channel at a time? Is that approximately true, Eric?
No, I tell you, that's the whole subject for discussion. That's why we have pre-equalizers that we use. The problem is not merely the light. The problem is the detectors and the emitters. They're not perfectly linear devices, and they're not, when you're talking about light, okay, the type of light modulation that you do, whether you're using a laser, an LED, or some other type of light sourcing device, even on the photoreceptor end, there are things that go on. So in theory, yeah, there's no group delay, but in reality, there's something that comes close that can be annoying, especially when you're doing digital.
Yeah, is it called OSP-384 standard? There's a standard that's either 10 gigs wide or 40 gigs wide. When you're using that particular standard, within a few megacycles that you use for a particular channel, I'd like to believe that dispersion is kind of small. But am I being naive on this one, Eric? Go ahead.
Not really. It is small. But, again, the problems are the sensing devices and the emitting devices. Okay? And there's a couple different types of modulations that's used. And it's not like in the analog day where you just take a capacitor coil and, you know, sweep the thing to the... put a sweep in one end and make it come out flat on the other and not worry about the other stuff so much, and maybe you had to do a little DG and DP because of the sensors on both ends. So as far as light is concerned, as far as the cable goes, you can have as little as much as you want cable, and the only thing that changes is the attenuation. The characteristics do not change whatsoever, but you do have to compensate for the errors that are made by the transmission and reception devices.
You just used the terms DG and DP. Is that delta group and delta phase? That's a pure guess on my part. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I should have been more clear. No, it isn't actually. It's what we call differential gain and differential phase. Don't forget a color signal in NTSC, which is going away, although the video standard isn't going anywhere. That's the basis for everything. Consists of two modulators, one being 90 degrees apart from each other, and the nonlinear effects of cable and disk components, change, group delay, and amplitude phase changes according to the device. And there's a lot of effort in broadcast gear to put differential gain, differential phase correctors, all centered around one frequency, 3.579545. Back to you, Dick.
And that magic frequency, 3.579545455, is the Comenant subcarrier, which is an isolated sideband transmission in IMQ, in phase and quadrature, allowing you to know the magnitude, which is color saturation, and the hue, which is the frequency, so to speak, of that particular color pixel. What a system. Hey, Gabe, we've kept you waiting an awful long time. Sorry about that. KB2MAR. Go right ahead with your question and comment, sir. K2RIW in the technical net. My name is Dick.
No problem on the waiting there. I just want to let you guys know that the coupons are available, the $40 coupons. I think households can get a maximum of two of them. Now, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to give you the telephone number over the air as to how to order those coupons on the internet, the website. Can I do that?
I don't think it's a problem because you're not making a profit on this. So, ham radio is not allowed to be used for financial remuneration, and you're not doing that. And you could also tell us what website address we would go to in order to find out this information for our particular area. But don't worry, Gabe. Go ahead. We'll just see you later.
Okay, basically the website is www.hdtv2009.com, and the telephone number to call is 1-888-388-2009. Basically, these coupons are good for 90 days. Now, they're saying that, you know, get them as soon as you can because when they run out, I don't know if you can get more of them. I don't know the situation on that. Maybe they'll reissue some more in 2009, I don't know, but I played it safe and I ordered mine already. Gave me two MHR back to net.
Can you please repeat that telephone number one more time? One more time on the telephone number?
Yeah, we will. Don't worry about that one, Eugene. Hotel Delta Tango Victor 2009.com. With WW in front of it. That's the website. It'll give you this information. The phone number itself you gave us, let me drop, is 1-888-388-2009. The 2009 is 2009, you could say. You know, that's the year that all this is going to happen. And so, 1-888-388-2009 is the phone number. The question I've got for you, Gabe, is that these are only useful for 90 days after you receive them, $40 coupons. I presume they're for down payment, so to speak, of a converter box and or a digital television. I wonder which or maybe both. And I see a slight disadvantage because every time I talk to Eric, there's another generation with more and more capability of the digital television converters that are available. So if we wait longer before buying our digital converter, in theory we're getting a little bit more quality, a little bit more capability, a little bit more fidelity, a little bit more horns and whistles, maybe a little bit more sensitivity. So if we wait before requesting the coupon, in theory we can get a later revision to the digital converter box. But if we wait too long, the coupons won't be available. If we get the coupon right away, maybe within the 90 days, the second generation that maybe I'm, if I had some kind of a priori knowledge that a sixth generation box is coming out.
It's going to take 3 years, Dick.
Okay, alrighty, so stop worrying. Alrighty, I see what Derek's going to tell us. Not to worry. But let's see what Gabe's got to say about this. And how did you find out this information, Gabe? Wonder if you're in the industry. KB2MAR, A2RIW, my name is Dick.
Well, basically, I was watching a television program. I was going through the channels, and I saw something about HDTV. And basically, they're saying that these coupons are good for 90 days. And it's for the your basic, it's a converter box to add to your existing analog television set. So that's basically how that works. And, you know, like you said, it'll just take the digital and convert it to analog. And like I said, 90 days they're good for. Two per household maximum, two coupons. I think, I mean, you should be able to obviously buy more converter boxes down the road, you know, to add more. They're not saying you can not only allow two boxes, you can actually, you know, get more boxes in the future. I'm pretty sure you can. But that's basically it. And let's see. Yeah, that's what was going through my head, too, about the thing being newer equipment coming out with better capabilities. But the other station there said that in 3 years, the sixth generation is going to come out, so I'm not too disappointed. Back to you.
NYS.
NYS recognized. We'll get to you in a second. As I see it, it's like a moving train, and you eventually got to get on it if you're going to watch television. We have no choice but to get on the train, just a matter of when. If you were about to buy yourself a laptop computer, if you're about to buy a handheld calculator, if you're about to buy a desktop computer, the technology is continuously changing. If you're about to buy a printer, color printer, a black and white printer, a laser printer, and so on, no matter what you buy, you start doing research and you realize it's a moving train. And you want to keep delaying as long as possible before you put down a great big chunk of cash to make sure you're going to get one that's not going to go obsolete tomorrow morning. And then again, the word obsolete is very relative as I see it. We all worry ourselves sick about, am I getting the best bang for the dollar for the one that I'm buying at this particular instant of time? And in reality, even if you get one that's a generation too old, with rare exception, it ain't that bad. The difference is kind of minor in many cases. Mr. NYS, give us your full call and your handle. My name is Dick. You got it, sir.
It's JR, W2NYS. Yeah, we're just doing that this afternoon. I went to the government's website. It's DTV.gov. And there was restrictions on there. You know, if you had cable in the house, and it also said coupons would not be valid if you bought any of the enhanced versions of the DTV converter box. People want. And like you said, it was been a maximum two coupons, $40 each. Yeah, they had restrictions about you know, whether or not you had cable in the house already. Check out the website. I think it's an FCC website.
Yeah, Jay, give us that website again. I heard deltatango.gov. So deltatango.gov with a www in front of it, question mark. Over to you, JR.
Yeah, deltatangovictor.gov.
Very good. So we go there. It's going to give us a lot of information. And it sure looks like after a number of hard dates in the past, this one is really going to be official. On February 17th, 2009, essentially all analog over-the-air television, with rare exception, will cease to exist. If you're not digitally equipped, you got nothing. If you're an over-the-air television watcher, is the impression I've got. Now, the $40 coupons for a standalone converter box that you either plug into your television, and there's a company out in Hapag called Hapag Computer Works, I think it is, that makes a whole bunch of products that you can plug into a computer, into other things that will give you digital television reception on your laptop computer, on your desktop computer, and things like this. As I said, they've got a whole series of products that look very attractive. They've been doing it now for quite a number of years, and I think their stock is increasing and their gross is increasing, so they're obviously doing something right. And once you find their website, you can look at their products. I think they've got a whole lot of products along these lines. Now, here's the question I got for Eric. If I buy a separate standalone converter box, and if I want one with all the horns and whistles and whatever, I am guessing I could spend $300 if I was so inclined. And the $40 coupons, and I presume you have to use one per purchase. You can't put two coupons against one single purchase, is my guess. So it looks like, thank goodness we are affluent people, we're willing to pay that extra money. But am I anywhere in the right ballpark for what you could pay if you want one that with full capability, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the technical net.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. First of all, this whole thing was dreamed up by the NTIA, which is the National Telecommunications and something other administration.
Yeah, I forget.
Oh, Information Administration. There you go. And actually, I went to their website just to take a peek, and it's www.dpv.2009.gov, and you can apply there. And, okay, so what is an eligible TV converter box? TV converter box models must meet tech and spec performance standards determined by the NTIA. A list of eligible make and model numbers for purchase with the coupon can be found at the website, which is ntia.gov. So, you know, you want fancy schmancy, you're going to pay for it. I think they're only printing like 7 or 12 million of these coupons anyway. It's really aimed at folks who can't afford to buy a new TV, so... You know, the end expected price is like $70 for the converter box. And with the $40, you know, you get a balance of something like $20 that you have to pay. So that's kind of the way it goes. I mean, if you want to buy something more than a plain vanilla box, then you're buying it. They're not.
K2KEY.
No recognized. Another question for you, Eric. If I want to buy the real bare-bones Yugo or Volkswagen version, I think you're saying they're not much cheaper than $75. Is that approximately true?
No, next year I expect to see the prices somewhere in the 60 to you know, $80. I think we bought a test box from a Korean company a couple of weeks ago that cost around $65. And it works like $65. It's got some real software problems in it, but they're working on it.
Very good. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, I got a bulletin that came, somebody gave me about a whole business with this, what's going to happen. And there's a couple of very big controversies here that are going to have to be straightened out. Number of places, for instance, you mentioned in one, www.digitaltvdtv.gov or www.dtvdigitaltv2009.gov, and there's a couple others, www.dtvtransition.org, and another one was protesting, www.hearusnow.org. These are all different websites of people that are putting up a stink, literally. And one of the things is now that the price for a converter box varies. There are places that were authorized right now are selling them, a Best Buy, Circuit City, Kmart, Radio Shack, Sam's Club, Sears, Target, Walmart, and their prices vary considerably. And the cutoff, they said, will be 90 days, but they said you must request coupons by March 31st, 2009, when they're going to make them available again. So, and here's a whole business about either the installation. Some of them people are taking advantage of it. That yes, you make it convert a Philly, but you should see some of the terms here for the installation. They're ridiculous. Over.
2H3W with a very important comment.
Go right ahead.
HWW, Dick.
Go ahead, Howie.
Second, I'm coming in from IRLP. You guys, you have to wait a half second. There's a major problem, and I understand there's going to be an injunction. People with disability, let's say you're blind, these boxes don't have tactile feedback, and they don't have, you see, they don't have... accessible, and under the Americans with Disability Act, it has to be accessible. Somehow, it has to be accessible that you can, you know, just because you don't see doesn't mean you can't listen to the TV. So there's a whole issue. And from what I understand, in the next couple of weeks, somebody's going into court and they're going to get an injunction. So I got a funny feeling this thing ain't going to happen on the date. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, Howie, you were there continuously. You got good audio, but your audio is about 7 dB too loud, very, very loud, and it's at the point of banging into the sides of the repeater and giving us a little bit of distortion. So hit your audio just a little bit lower. And I can see how Americans with Disability have got a whole another set of issues that have got to be considered. Looks like what we call television, our free television services that we have, essentially free television services, other than those who are smart enough to support the public broadcasting system. But we don't pay a tax like they do for the British television. They pay a tax, and in theory the tax is different whether or not the television receiver is a monochrome or a polychrome receiver. Of course, I presume an awful lot of people in the United Kingdom are claiming that that is an old-fashioned black and white. They don't have to pay as much tax, but theirs is really supported. We've got a whole bunch of issues. Television is certainly going through an interesting transition, and the digital world and computers looks like they're really going to dominate. These compression techniques, MPEG, Motion Picture Experimental Group is what I think MPEG stands for. And I believe the real inventor of many of those schemes is a very smart electronic engineer who lives in northern Italy. And I think he's come up with schemes for MPEG number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, where you get more and more compression if you're willing to make the compromise in some of the picture quality. And when the picture moves too fast and the system can't keep up with it, you see these pixelated sections, little bitty squares of artifacts, but they're usually rather brief, and for the average person it's not very annoying, unless, as I said, it was the movie Grand Prix, and you want to really watch Yves Montand behind the wheel of a very high power machine, and you want to look at it frame by frame and slow it down with your TiVo or whatever, and find out what really happened in that accident, and did the technician's hand appear in the picture for one of the frames before it got edited out, things like that. There are people who just love looking for that kind of jazz. I guess before it gets too late, we ought to go over to Paul and find out what's going on in space. A lot of interesting things are happening there. Then we'll go back, see if we got any additional questions. And then Mel is going to go into his mailbag and tell us what very challenging questions he's gotten this week that we're trying to catch up on. So, Paul, WS2N, if you're ready.
H-U-L-A-W
in the
TechNet. Okay, Dick, very good. And, the TV problem, I was thinking about that, too. All these little portable TVs, I use one with no antenna input. It's just a regular telescopic antenna. You throw all of those things away, I guess, unless you're going to try to go inside all these tiny TVs and put a converter box in. Wow. Sounds like problems. I'm sure we'll hear more about it. Maybe at the end of the net, Dick, we'll hear more about that, too. The space report is, two important things that are going on is the Atlantis is still up at the International Space Station. They had an extended day up there. They successfully berthed and bumped it up the Columbus European Space Agency's $2 billion new home attached to the space station. after three spacewalks to do that. All the work, of course, is dedicated directly to the new lab. When they're on spacewalks, they do get ahead work for next time, or they're bringing back some gyroscopes from the space station, putting them into the cargo bay of the shuttle. But overall, most of the work was dedicated to the Columbus lab. So that new 23-foot-long, 14-diameter room is now installed. They say to flow from one end to the other, it takes like a half a minute from one end of the space station to the other. All the doors were open, and there's a lot of doors, probably about 10, 15 doors. If they were all closed, you'd have to open up that many to get from one end to the other. So if you gave yourself a push, just floating free, it would take you half a minute to get from one side to the other. So it's getting big up there. And another module going up there very soon on the next flight. The Kobe module built by Japan. Another room, another lab. That's going to take a couple of flights to get that completely up there. So a little bit bigger, more involved. That stands for HOPE in Japanese. So that's coming along. I just also wanted to mention the missile that they plan on shooting up to out of space to knock out the spy satellite. Have you heard about this, Vic?
I had to switch mics. Yes, I did. And as I understand it, it is a reconnaissance type of a satellite which failed to respond correctly, became a piece of junk in space, so to speak, didn't boost itself to the right orbit. It's due to re-enter, and so rather than have some of the very large modules that are in there that might survive re-entry, the two things they're worried about is it could strike a habitable area and or some of the technology on board would be compromised. If you saw the PBS program on Astro Spies, that was shown a number of times last week, fascinating show about the subject of the parallel astronaut program we had for both surveillance and reconnaissance work, as well as the normal Mercury, Apollo, and Gemini program. So we had two parallel sets of astronauts there for a while, and the Soviet Union was doing the same thing. So monitoring each other's military activity was very important at one time. Boy, the world has changed. So still there is the technology that was mentioned on the PBS program is that they were always seeking 3-inch resolution on the ground from space on picture taking, let's call it. So each nation has its proprietary information as to how they accomplish that or even better, and as such they don't want that hardware to fall into the wrong hands. So I guess they're about to shoot up a missile to make sure that the particles are broken up real small so that when it re-enters, the chances of surviving the re-entry without burning up and still be analyzable essentially goes to zero. I think that's approximately what's going on. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW in the technical net.
And WB2EAB has another quick question to add to that list.
We're going to get to you right after that, Ed.
As to when. Should I continue, Dick?
Absolutely. I'll worry about the timer every 3 minutes, Paul. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that's on. Okay, very good. Dick, the that satellite, launched in 2006 in December. Failed right away. Computers, everything, power. So it has all its fuel on board, the hydrazine fuel for maneuvering, has really never been used. So the story goes that the reason they want to shoot this thing down, other satellites have come down and they've never tried to shoot one down, is because of the hydrazine fuel. Hydrazine fuel is what they use for attitude adjustments in flight. The shuttle has some 30 somewhat rockets that are fired by hydrazine fuel. Apollo's use them. very popular fuel for attitude control in outer space. And the same holds true for the spy satellites. So this stuff, if you come into contact with it, it's caustic. You can inhale it, you're sick. You drop dead if you really get close to it. If you're as close to within a football field or so, is the report that came out. And that's the reason they want to shoot this thing down. Let me drop it. The problem is, many people are saying, it's a spy satellite. We don't want the satellite to get into anybody else's hands, number one. And it's also a couple of thousand pound thing that's flying around in outer space that parts will probably make it down to Earth, and they don't want it to hit anything. Again, they've never really worried about that before. Three-quarters of the Earth is water. Chances are we'll probably land in water. Although I don't never go along with that. Skylab did hit Australia when that came down. Russian Cosmos satellite came down that had uranium on it. It landed in Canada. The main reason, though, they say, is this hydrazine fuel that's on board. And they're going to shoot it down with this SM-3 satellite. They're going to launch it from a cruiser out in the North Pacific, the Lake Erie. It launches from the back of this big cruiser, missile cruiser. SM stands for Standard Missile, by the way. The SM-3 is a three-stage rocket that will be going up, trying to hit this thing at a little over 100 miles in altitude. When this missile is going 6,000 miles per hour, it's going to be no match to the speed of the 17,000 mile an hour satellite that's moving. And it's the kinetic energy that destroys the satellite. It's not like it's got a nuclear warhead on board or even a conventional warhead. It's the kinetic energy that will destroy that satellite. They've done this kind of thing before. It's been like 9 out of 11 times from this one ship, the USS Lake Erie. Let me drop it there. They've launched satellites from, they've launched missiles anyway, from Barking Sands out in Hawaii. And they've taken shots before. And like I said, most of the times they do hit these things at about 100 miles up. Although the ones that they've been hitting haven't been going 17,000 miles an hour. So that remains to be seen on how well they do. They seem to think that it's going to work. They're $400,000 missiles. The whole procedure is going to cost 10 times that amount to try to do this with all the other boats and backup ships that are involved. In case this missile fails, they'll use another one from another ship. And they say the impact is equal to 130 megajoules. And they gave a description of what I read on the internet was the equivalent of a 10-ton truck hitting something at 600 miles per hour. So that's the kinetic energy that's involved. And we'll see how this thing goes. Three-stage thing. It's an expensive rocket. It's got a main booster, it's got steering control above that, and it's got another stage above that, another steering assembly, and then they've got the guidance. The third stage it's got a guidance section right below that. And then it's got this heavy kinetic, warhead on top. And we'll see how this thing goes. Launched from this Ticonderoga class guided missile cruiser deck. So if you bring up the USS Lake Erie on the images for Google, you can see what this thing looks like, what the ship looks like. And a couple of the pictures have missiles shooting out of the back of it. So you can see what this thing looks like when it takes off from the North Pacific. Back to you, Dick. Back to the net. This is WS2M.
One last question, Eric. I mean, Paul, and that is, when is that blast off of the SM3 anticipated to take place? If you happen to know, you got a Paul.
The newspaper said a week, and they said about a week or so on the news conference that I saw on TV. Military, I don't know, I'm not sure if he was a general or I forgot his name, or an admiral. I think he was involved with the Pentagon anyway. Back to you, Dick.
Very good. Let's see what Ed's got to say. WB2EAV. What's the latest in Jericho? You've got it, Ed.
For decades, a classic rocket fuel has been hydrazine and oxygen, which tells me hydrazine, I would assume, is quite flammable. As this thing re-enters and starts to burn up in the atmosphere, by that logic, I would assume the hydrazine would ignite and more make the thing a bomb than anything else. Either A, what is the flaw in my logic, or B, does it show that maybe they're just giving that as an excuse? Dick, WB2EAV.
Heat shield. Yeah, by way of, some of the portions of the mass of this large object may act as a heat shield, intentionally or unintentionally. The hydrazine tank is made to be extremely sturdy. As such, it may survive. And I believe hydrazine and nitrous oxide is what gets mixed together in these... I can't even think of the name of the darn little motors now that are used all over the space shuttle and other vehicles in order to do positioning. So I can see how they could really be worried about it surviving the reentry, and it's a very toxic substance. When you go to any of the websites for the European Space Agency in Kourou, I guess it's a British Columbia, is it? I can't think of the name of the country, but... the European Space Agency site in South America, and you look at the bunny suits, or it's actually a lot more than a bunny suit, but it's a very heavy protective gear that they wear when they're fueling up any of these space vehicles. They really worry about the toxicity, high lethality of all of these chemicals. So I can see a bunch of reasons, both to protect the technology, to protect the people with the stuff that may re-enter, and you're between a rock and a hard place when you... design the tank for the hydrazine, and you do an extremely good job, and you think it's never going to be re-entering, and here we are re-entering it. So I got some ideas to what's going on there, Ed. WB2EAV, and how well equipped are you for digital television, Ed? WB2EAV, K2LIW in the technical net. Glad to hear from you. This is kind of late at night for you.
Me too, LSR.
LSR recognized. Ed, you got it.
All right, first, I find it hard to believe that something that was not intended to re-enter would have heat shield, but that's neither here nor there. I do have a question about digital TV. I have a VHF-only antenna with one television, which brings up a question. When you put a converter box, what's going to be coming in my VHF antenna? Or the guy down the street with a VHF-UHF antenna, is what's going to be coming through his antennas, other than data format, is it going to be the same content, or are things going to be totally different?
And WS-1, quick comment on previous topic.
Okay, let's find out what... It sounded like WB2LSR, Lima Sierra Romeo, but I know I have that wrong. Give me a correction of your call letters, your name, and your question or comment, sir. My name is Dick. I thought it was LSR. Are you still there, sir?
Oh, W2OSR, Dick.
Sir.
Sorry about that. Okay. Go right ahead, Bob. Our secretary, please proceed, sir.
Okay. Let's see what I can remember from when I worked on the space program. Hydrazine, when mixed with hydrogen peroxide, the peroxide providing the oxygen and the hydrogen providing the hydrogen component. When those two items are mixed together, they combine what's called a hyperbolic fuel, which means something that lights up with it by itself without putting a match to it. The problem with hydrazine is it's a very highly corrosive chemical. Over.
Yeah, those hypergolic chemicals explode on contact, and yeah, very toxic stuff. So, I think that alone is more than enough reason to shoot at it, as I see it. And these kinetic kill weapons, because you're coming up there with a surface-to-air missile that's moving at 6,000 miles an hour, but it itself is moving at 17,500, so it's the velocity of the satellite itself that does the destruction. It's really a reverse. You just put up the target, and it hits the target. And my guess is a small charge that's in the warhead just simply spreads out the shrapnel, so to speak, so that it presents a cone of destruction that the satellite will then drift through that cone and experience all kinds of damage. That's essentially the way many of these surface-to-air missile weapons work. Although in case of a usual surface-to-air missile weapon, the missile itself is moving at 3,000 miles an hour, and that does the damage. Here it's a reverse, as I see it. I'm not sure now. There were a couple of people who signed in, and I wasn't smart enough to write down their call letters. Who also wanted to make a question or a comment?
WS2N.
Paul, was there a second person?
Yeah, W1EAV, just want to say good evening.
Okay, Mr. EAV, thank you. Paul, you...
W2HO.
You've got a Paul.
Okay, and Dick, yeah, I just wanted to mention, well, a couple of Guyana is what you were thinking of down in South America, where they launch all those Ariane rockets, by the European Space Agency. This, according to what I read, this is not supposed to detonate at all when it's up in space. It's the third stage, when it gets up there, it's... on its way up, it's receiving all the information from the radar, from the ships. The ship's sending the information up to the satellite as it's going up. When it gets in its area where it wants to be, it has infrared sensors on board the third stage. It does have attitude control up there on the third stage, so it sees, I guess that's the right word, it sees the oncoming satellite, and it will use its attitude control to get right in its way. And this thing is not, it doesn't say it's an exploding mechanism at all. I mean, it's supposed to be a kinetic, they call it a kinetic warhead, is what they're calling it. They call it. Whether it breaks up or not, they don't say that. I mean, that could be, but I haven't read that. Back to you, WS.
Yeah, I'm guessing they call it a warhead, and there is a fractionalization of that warhead, a very small charge to spread out that material at just the right instant of time so that it represents a reasonably large target with a high probability of intercept. If you didn't do that, then if you kept the warhead all together, and just the solid warhead try to strike the spacecraft, you're then doing the equivalent of trying to hit a bullet with a bullet, and your probability of kill goes down very fast because of there's always errors in your navigation. It's a very difficult navigation problem to shoot something from the ground and intercept something in space. You'd be amazed how many degrees of freedom there is in that particular problem. You may be exactly in the right place, but there at the wrong time, or vice versa. Be there at the right time, but in the wrong place. And in the wrong place can be azimuth elevation and azimuth elevation range, and so on. Pretty complicated, three-dimensional. It's really a four-dimensional problem. There's three dimensions of space plus time. You gotta make it all come back together. So I am guessing there really is a small charge separating the pieces of shrapnel at just the right instant of time to present a what's usually called the cone of destruction. Now, let's see, there was Mr. OHL and another person. Who was the other person first who wanted to make a question or a comment? Give me a call letter as a name right now.
Yeah, I'll just say good evening. Name's Chris, calls Whiskey 1 Echo Alpha Victor. Just wanted to say hello and welcome to 9126. I'm usually on the 9123. Note 4568.